Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com.
Tennessee sounds perfect.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm going out with the girls this weekend. Nails done. Outfit stunner. And my skin? I know it's going to be glowing because I glammed up my shower routine with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. It smells so luxurious and deeply moisturizes with its super rich, creamy lather that's bursting with vitamin B3 complex. So my skin glows and my confidence grows. Try new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash for glowing skin in just 14 days.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's give a special shout out to our guest super producer, Tari Harrison.
You ready? Let's do this.
Tari, she's filling in for the Max. Yeah, Tari, it's Tari. She's really awesome, yeah.
Woo. Thanks for covering me while I was off, Tari. I enjoy time off, and I enjoy you helping me out. So here's a song as a thank you. Oh, yeah. Woo.
Who you may recognize from Ridiculous News. And check out Ridiculous News if you haven't done so yet. I'm Ben, you're Noel. And people can hear us on Ridiculous News. We also had the creators of the show, Mark and Bill, on. We should have them back on again. You know what? We should have Ridiculous Crime and Ridiculous Romance back on at some point.
That's for sure. I'm still waiting for my invitation to be on Ridiculous News.
What? I thought you were on there.
Nah, man.
Tari, I need you to feel the strength of the side eye. I know you could see it.
So, bordering on an evil eye.
Which we discussed in a secret project for a different show that we'll tell you about hopefully very soon. I don't know, Halloween-ish maybe? Halloween-esque time? Mm-hmm. Circa Halloween?
Yeah, sure. Well, speaking of resentment and boiling, simmering rage, just kidding, it's cool. I love those guys. It's okay if they never want to have me on. I'll be fine with that, but I will also die a little inside. So please take note. Really want to be on Ridiculous News. Love the show. We are today talking about a very specific type of resentment that comes along with feeling as though you're being replaced. We're sort of in a situation with that right now in the country, in the world, where technology is starting to creep in and replace jobs that were once, you know, largely occupied by human people. Things like checkout kiosks at stores and, you know, even the idea of AI coming in and replacing the work of graphic designers, you know, with some of these open, you know, DALL-E AI kind of images, or Midjourney. You know, there's a lot of unease in the art community around the idea of being able to just enter some text and generate an image that technically is plumbing the depths of the work of other artists that is available on the internet to kind of create this simulacrum of art. Mm-hmm. But we are talking about kind of the earliest days of this concept, the idea of skilled workers feeling, not just feeling, you know, scared, but genuinely being sacked because their jobs were no longer required due to advancements in technology during the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. Now, this one is of a special interest to me and to you, I believe, as well as our research associate, the one and only Zach Williams, who, again, you'll meet very soon in an upcoming episode. You may have heard someone call someone else a Luddite, like, or you may hear someone explain their relationship with a technology they don't get, right? Like, hey guys, sorry, I had a tough time with this Adobe product or this DocuSign. I'm kind of a Luddite. But it's used, it's weird because it's kind of like those same way people say, you're a Philistine. There's a story behind these terms, and it's a story that we think a lot of people don't fully realize. The Luddites, as you so beautifully set us up here to explore, Noel, they were a real people. And when I say people, I don't mean like a nation. It's a real community of people. And around the turn of 1800, our story begins. The textile industry in the United Kingdom, it's a huge, huge deal. As a matter of fact, in the north of the UK around this time, a ton of people in one way or another worked in the textile industry, and it was partially still a cottage industry, right? People were working from home, literally in their cottages, and they were doing time-intensive labor by hand. They were making stockings. Cotton spinners were creating yarn. And I think one group that's particularly interesting to us today would be the croppers. They take these large sheets of this woven wool fabric, and then they clean it up. They trim off the rough surface so it's all nice and smooth.
Yeah, like a nice, soft, cozy blankie. To back up one half-inch bit, where at what point do you think the concept of spinning a yarn became a euphemism for telling a story?
Oh, that's a great question. And we see this pretty often, not just in English, but in other languages. A description of a physical act becomes a figurative thing. It becomes an idiom or a turn of phrase, right? Like, we'll cross that bridge when we get there, you know? I don't know. I guess it would say, I had heard, weirdly enough, that it came from nautical slang.
Well, it also reminds me of the idea of spinning a story from whole cloth. The idea of making something up from scratch, you know, or that would be considered, you know, telling a lie, which sometimes a story can just be a very theatrical lie. But I love the idea of you're taking what essentially is raw material and you're turning it into something of beauty, which I think is a very appropriate, metaphor for telling a story. But sorry, I just wanted to get that out of the way. You know, I'm always hung up on these little things. So this was a very important job. These croppers, the ones that you were describing as kind of trimming the fabric and making it really, really smooth and soft. They had to be muscular folks because they had to, like, you know, use these big kind of heavy pieces of machinery to guide them across the fabric to get these, you know, these trimmings done. They also were incredibly well paid because they did have to have a special set of skills, like Liam Neeson style. And therefore, they commanded a significant amount of control over their work life. There was something that we have completely come to take for granted or take for not granted because we don't have it, is the work-life balance. This was a very important thing. They had holidays built in. They even took Mondays off so they could get drunk. They called it Saint Monday. It was, bizarre. And this is all, like, kind of, they were able to demand this even before the time of unions. There may have been, you know, a guild, which would have probably had some kind of collective bargaining power, you know, or at least what would kind of be the equivalent of that back in those days. But they were able to really get a lot of perks.
Yeah. And they were known throughout the industry and the country as being the least manageable of any employed people. This started to become a problem in the first 10 years of the 1800s. The textile industry was in trouble. There was a decade of war with Napoleon that had halted trade. And again, an interesting parallel to today and the looming supply chain crisis, the cost of food and everything you could buy, the cost of living in general, is going up pretty significantly. Also, the textile industry is inherently part of the fashion industry, and fashion, as we know, is fickle. Check out our episodes on fashions of yesteryear. Men began wearing a different type of clothing. They started rocking these things called trousers, which were spelled T-R-O-W-S-E-R-S at the time, which meant demand for stockings plummeted. And the merchant class, the folks who, you know, make their vig off of paying hosiers and croppers and then weavers and then selling the finished product, they had to figure out a way to contain these rising costs. So the first thing they did was attempt to reduce wages while at the same time bringing in, ding, 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 new improved technology, new kinds of rigs, new processes. In particular, one thing called a gig mill. And a gig mill would let a single person crop wool much, much more quickly than the old methods. You know, it reminds me of this great Mitchell and Webb sketch about the, Stone Age entering the Bronze Age. Did you ever see that one?
I don't think I saw that one. I love those guys, but definitely haven't seen every bit of their show.
I'll send it to you after this.
Please.
Also, sometimes folks peek behind the ridiculous curtain. It is not uncommon for us to pause recording and watch things that we send to each other. But we're being pros today, so I'll just send it to you after work. But it'll Solid. Be worth it. Solid. Yes. So this other stuff they do, man. The merchant class, they have these new frames, wide stocking frames. And these stocking frames will let a weaver produce stockings 6 times faster than before. To me, there's a question for me here, though. If stockings are already going out of fashion, I guess there's still some sort of demand, but it seems like maybe not the most productive thing to make the product people don't want 6 times faster.
Yeah, I guess it would have been what they would have referred to as their woolens, you know? Like, I think possibly a combination of defenses against the cold, but also I think they were probably really popular in puritanical sets, you know? The idea of making sure that your legs were covered and all of that good stuff, if you were a woman. But it was veering out of that more puritanical territory and into the Enlightenment, essentially, right? I mean, that's where we were heading.
Well, they did this, you know, they did something that really lays down the precedent for a lot of worker-employer tensions in the modern day. If we look at the specifics here of this stocking change, then what would happen is instead of weaving an entire stocking around by hand, you produce this big sheet of hosiery, basically stocking material. You cut it up and then you would put it together. The problem was the quality just wasn't there. These cut up stockings would fall apart quickly, but you didn't need highly skilled, highly trained workers to make them. And the merchants don't care. We're also, we owe a shout out to Clive Thompson over at the Smithsonian because he wrote a fantastic article about this.
Yeah, with a really great headline too. When robots take all of our jobs, remember the Luddites, as we were talking about kind of at the top of the show. This is not a brand new concept, this concern of being replaced, you know, by a machine. And certainly these were not quote unquote smart machines, but technology in and of itself, Ben, as you often like to say, I can't remember who exactly the quote is from, but
Arthur C. Clarke,
you know, in a certain context is indistinguishable from magic. So you have this very powerful force. Let's call it, you know, technological magic that's sweeping in and replacing the job of several individuals. And this is not going unnoticed. I mean, this is, you know, again, we had these croppers that were occupying a very kind of privileged position in the workforce. They were able to get these demands met, you know, all their vacation time and their perks and their pay. And now all of a sudden, well, we don't need you anymore, or at least we don't need as many of you.
Yeah, no longer in the catbird seat. The merchant's cost-cutting gambit actually works out for them, or appears to for a time. We owe a nod of thanks to Kevin Binfield, an English professor at Murray State University, and a guy who actually is the editor of Writings of the Luddites, which is an excellent work on this time period and this movement. So, Professor Binfield notes that the lace workers, the knitters, the you name it's of the textile industry realize things are in decline, in big part because of the supply chain problems and inflation due to the war. But they also see that people aren't worried as much about quality. These folks who are experts in their field have been, this might sound familiar to some of our fellow friends who worked from home during the pandemic, these individuals watched as their work was moved from the houses where they lived to these big factories that would house cotton weaving machines. And the workers started to protest, rabble, 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 grumble, grumble, grumble. And they said, you know what? You guys are making lower quality stuff. And several of them said, you know what, I am down to clown as long as I make a little bit of this profit too. But Noel, I get the feeling history will show us they weren't getting profit sharing from this.
Of course they weren't, because that's how, you know, scaling and industrialization works. You know, you take what was once a cottage industry, perhaps a skill passed down from generations, you know, from mother to daughter, you know, the art of lace making, very, very subtle and bespoke kind of work that goes into that. And then all of a sudden you're doing it on this grand scale in this massive factory with unskilled workers. And understandably, you know, you would see that if you were one of those skilled workers, and this was a very important part of your upbringing and your family heritage or whatever it might be, you're going to take that really personally. It's the same as, you know, the kind of commodification of any art form. It takes the magic out of it. It kind of takes the heart and the soul out of it. And sure, industrialists and, you know, corporate bigwigs, they're not so concerned about the quality as they are about the quantity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so these artisans try to head things off at the pass. Another phrase that was literal and became figurative. Or, you know, they say, maybe we can slow it. Maybe we can make this a smooth transition over time. So they looked for stuff like workers' pensions, a new step in the world of workers' rights. And the factory owners didn't want to play ball. So kind of like unions that have been in pretty tense, sometimes hostile negotiations with companies in the U.S. today, the factory owners said, no, we're not doing it. And that's where the Luddite movement emerges.
I'm going out with the girls this weekend. Nails done. Outfit stunner. And my skin? I know it's going to be glowing because I glammed up my shower routine with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. It smells so luxurious and deeply moisturizes with its super rich, creamy lather that's bursting with vitamin B3 complex. So my skin glows and my confidence grows. Try new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash for glowing skin in just 14 days.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah, it was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac, Bonnevilles.
El Camino. right?
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one, and that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino, and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it so. The Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
You know, Ben, I got to say, one of the best parts of a spring cleaning is that post-clean clarity you get where you're like, man, how have I been living like this? What's wrong with me?
You're right. No, it's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan.
It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month.
To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only.
Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply.
See Mint Mobile for details. These attempts at negotiation fail. The workers aren't being listened to. Their concerns aren't being addressed. We can also give you a little bit of political context, larger context, just so you know how bad things are at this time. Thousands of people in the UK, not just in this industry, are suffering from chronic hunger, what we call food insecurity today. And there were these laws passed by Parliament called combination laws. Combination laws were directly aimed against collective action by textile workers. It's kind of like if Congress passed a law specifically aimed at, podcasters or something like that. It's weirdly specific.
Yeah, and just to backtrack on something that I said earlier, in terms of the croppers being able to get all of these demands met, all of these, privileges in terms of their vacation and their pay and all that. A lot of stuff was happening around this time. In 1860, the first recorded trade union was established, the London Trades Council. This is in the UK anyway, the London Trades Council, which was founded in 1816. And then a little bit later, the Trades Union Congress in 1868. But Ben, when was this combination law passed? Because I'm trying to, there's a lot of upheaval, the French Revolution was not far off from here. The Industrial Revolution encompasses a lot of this and the Enlightenment period. There's a lot of overlap here.
The combination, so there are a series of combination laws, I believe. For example, one is the Combination Act of 1799 that explicitly outlaws unions. And obviously, that doesn't stick around forever because, as you said, this union forms in the 1860s later. So Luddites go underground. They go clandestine. They start organizing in secret. This is one of the most cool work meetings you could imagine, but it's also a very desperate series of meetings. People are unable to feed their families. And this is not meant as that convenient term that politicians trot out every election day, they're literally not able to feed their families. And they say, you know what? This is going to take everybody. If we are not a male-only organization, women workers get involved, child laborers, which were still very much a thing, you're part of this movement too. Eventually, women and children formed something around 40% of the Luddite membership, which was very progressive for its time, despite, you know, child labor.
Yeah, highly recommend a cool article called The Future Encyclopedia of Luddism by Miriam A. Cherry. You can find that on thereader.mitpress.mit.edu. Really, really great resource for all kinds of fantastic historical, I guess, journalism.
Yeah. And this is, okay, so what they're doing now is not the same stuff that you would see a group of workers do in a more ostensibly democratic society. They're not necessarily just doing protest. You know what I mean? Starting in 1811, which is the first year of some really intense Luddite activity. So they do have a peaceful gathering near the Exchange Hall in Nottingham. And that doesn't stay peaceful because later they attack these wide knitting frames in a nearby shop in a village called Arnold. And the month before that, stockingers, which were framework knitters, broke into shops and removed various components of knitting frames that made them useless and incredibly dangerous to use if you tried. This attack on March 11th, 1811, is, as far as we can tell, the first time the name Ludd was used, right? So Luddite would be follower of Ludd?
That's right. Yeah. Like it was this kind of symbolic figure, this idea of a general, someone leading the charge, but I don't think it was actually a real person, right?
It's okay, so it's still kind of dodgy. Today in 2022, as we record, the movement was said pretty often to be named after a guy named Ned Ludd, an apprentice who smashed some stocking frames in 1779. So people associated this figure with the destruction of machines. But later it turned out that Ned Ludd was a totally fictional character. He was a story people told themselves. And then, as you pointed out, later this develops into a more fleshed out kind of character, synonymous with the cause. General Ludd, or King Ludd, is sort of like the Uncle Sam of this movement. We need you to join the croppers.
Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what happened. It was this kind of concerted effort to organize and almost create what we might today consider acts of industrial sabotage, right?
Yes.
I mean, this is bigger than just people that don't like machines or cannot computer. These are people who are resentful to the point of, you know, violence of these new developments because they are directly impacting their ability to feed their families.
Yeah. Yeah. They said, look, you're making crappy material. And secondly, you're employing people who have not completed their 7-year apprenticeship. Those folks that you might call scabs today were called cults back then, C-O-L-T-S. And so there are more and more attacks. There were several weeks of almost nightly attacks. They were all successful. No one was caught or arrested. And that kind of implies that the common person was on the side of the Luddites. Things go a little quiet in summer, but then there's a bad harvest in November. And this is where we see, this is where it gets sticky because we've established that General Ludd is sort of a semi-fictional character, right? So this is where we go back to the article cited earlier by Miriam A. Cherry. They started in November of 1811, surrounding and holding factories throughout the textile district of Nottinghamshire. And I'm so sorry,
fellow UK friends and ridiculous historians. My tongue is tripping over Nottinghamshire. Is it Nottinghamshire? Nottinghamshire.
Well, I think the Shire, you could say it as just Nottingham or Nottinghamshire. And I only say Shire because that's how they say it in A Day in the Life, the Beatles song. They say 10,000 holes in Blackford, Lancashire. So I think that might be a colloquial pronunciation. But I think Nottingham and Nottinghamshire are the same thing. I think it's just like a little extra oomph. But it's no accident that there are all these militaristic terms being used. You know, we do know that there was a real person named George Meller who took on the, you know, military leadership title of lieutenant and was described as being General Ludd's right-hand man. But again, like you said, a lot of the details around Ludd and his identity are a little bit sketchy. But this was war, Ben. They surrounded a textile district, and they literally held position in these factories. And they won at Cartwright Mill at Rawfolds. Is now, to this day, the site of the Meller Memorial Museum, where you can see lots of documentation pertaining to the Luddite movement. Again, read this article by Cherry in the MIT Press. It's fantastic. If you ever find yourself there, I'm sure this would be a great visit. But essentially, you know, while the Luddites do get a bit of a rap as being these kind of almost at least terrorists in a sense, at least, you know, again, one person's freedom fighters, another person's terrorists, it started off as a peaceful movement.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of the early campaigns were successful because of that pacifist nature. They were largely a peaceful movement. And when the press, which was owned by the powers that be, when the press was describing these factory occupations, they were trying to make it seem more militaristic and perhaps violent than it actually was. But we see that things did escalate. The common people are with them. The press is against them. The ownership class is certainly against them. Some of these attacks used sledgehammers, and the factory owners, as far as we could tell, were the first to produce firearms and fire upon protesters. The workers were hoping that they could essentially create such a stink that there would be a ban on weaving machines. But the British government doubled down. Instead, they made breaking machines a crime punishable by death.
Dang.
Yeah, I know. Imagine the death penalty for, what you would maybe consider just plain old vandalism.
I mean, it doesn't remind me, it doesn't strike me as being too different from allowing the idea of personhood to corporations. You know what I mean? It really shows where our priorities are, like in terms of like, you know, commerce is that no, these machines are every bit as valuable and have as much of a right to live as human beings do. In fact, I would argue more of a right to live because the machines themselves are causing the deaths and starvation and displacement of actual human people. So you can almost argue that the government is assigning more value to the machines than they are to the human beings themselves by, you know, making the destruction of these machines a crime worthy of the death penalty.
It's nuts. It's nuts. I don't even think it's an argument. That's totally what they're doing. It is a profits over people kind of situation. And then, you know, from the other side of this argument, the business owners would probably say, well, why are you restricting my freedom to make a more successful business? The economy is tough. It's a tale as old as time. So it might be strange to realize, after all the stuff we're describing, folks, that in the first 2 years of the Luddite campaign, you know, when things really pop off in 1811 to 1812, there's only one serious injury we know of, and that is a guy named William Horsfall. He's the owner of the Ottowells Mill. He refuses to stand down when a crowd of protesters gathers outside his factory. And then he says, it's not funny because, you know, it's people's lives, but you know, in response to their demands and protests, Horsfall says, "I plan to swim in Luddite blood." And he fires his rifle out into the crowd, which is mostly unarmed. And he's composed again of a lot of child workers. This guy that we introduced earlier, Lieutenant Mellor, he fires a single shot and he's thinking, "I'm going to wing this guy on the arm." But instead, he shoots him in his junk and shoots it right in the groin. Oof. Not on purpose, apparently.
No, no. He really was just trying to wing him, but instead he dinged him.
Hmm? Yeah, there we go.
I'm going out with the girls this weekend. Nails done. Outfit stunner. And my skin? I know it's going to be glowing because I glammed up my shower routine with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. It smells so luxurious and deeply moisturizes with its super rich, creamy lather that's bursting with vitamin B3 complex. So my skin glows and my confidence grows. Try new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash for glowing skin in just 14 days.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody. Like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one, and that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino, and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it so. The Monte Carlo was tough. I owned a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
So at this point, essentially, there was something of a surrender, right?
Yeah. They take over the factory without further incident. There were some people in the ruling class who were on board with the Luddites. Lord Byron wrote a poem about it called Song for the Luddites. And he mentions the character of King Ludd or General Ludd or Ned Ludd. And this is, again, this kind of the Uncle Sam for them. This is the leader who exists as a man of mystery, right? His powers are as pervasive as his enigmatic nature. No one really knows who he is. No one knows where he's at or where he'll strike. Maybe this is propaganda. I believe you could make a strong case that it is, but no, this propaganda works. The forces of law and order are kind of spooked by this guy, and they start obsessing over finding Ned Ludd. And, well, like we kind of spoiled the lead, there was no Ned Ludd. This was a made-up thing. We talked about the story. He became a symbolic leader. He became a folk hero in Nottingham, which, you know, has a past with folk leaders. Shout out Robin Hood. And there's actually a verse we found that compares the two. How you feel about a dramatic reading, Mr. Brown?
Absolutely. I just wanted to add, too, it really reminds me of V for Vendetta. The idea
that
you can't kill an idea. You can't kill, you know, something that's bigger than a man or, you know, an individual.
Che Guevara, shoot fool, you're only killing a man.
That's exactly right. And this is how these kind of movements really do get into the hearts and minds of people and can actually, you know, potentially overturn the status quo. It's not through violence, it's through the spread of ideas and, you know, kind of changing people's minds. But yeah, let's do this dramatic reading. It's so good.
Chant no more your old rhymes about bold Robin Hood. His feats I but little admire. I will sing the achievements of General Ludd, now the hero of Nottinghamshire.
See, now this tells us how you pronounce it. This is the rhyme.
Shire
and Shire.
There we go. We solved it. Dum dum. Shout out to Casey on the case. I miss you. So this Luddite revolt, which we can call it now, spreads to Yorkshire during 1812, then to Lancashire. And as this movement expands, it starts to fragment a little bit. Differing trades join in with differing priorities, right? And you may find that the tenets of the Luddite movement in one part of the country are different from the tenets of the movement in another region. It also became more violent as it grew in size and picked up momentum. They started setting mills on fire. So it went from occupation to arson. And then they started firing back at the guards of factories and mills and at the law that was set upon them. In 1812, four Luddites die. And this sort of changes the tenor. So I want to step back. Let me clarify. The initial parts of the movement, the initial phases and that year, 1811, those were largely peaceful. Our real inflection point is around this time of April, 1812.
Yeah. And you know, it just goes to show how history remembers things. You know, the term Luddite typically conjures images of people smashing stuff up, you know, if you're even remotely familiar with the actual history of it. If you're not, it's just typically, like you said, thrown around just to describe someone that isn't very good at using technology. Doesn't necessarily hate it or want it to be exploded, but it usually just like Philistines describing someone that doesn't have much taste or is culturally like not very refined. But again, the actual history of that is much more complex than what it is ultimately kind of boiled down to over time.
Maybe we do. You know what? We're just going to have to do an etymology show at some point.
Etymology for the people. Idiomatic for the people.
For the people. We need them back.
It's kind of the same deal.
The boys back.
We could do that.
So, as we said, things are getting violent. The factory owners are much more influential in the government because they have much more money. And eventually, the government sends 14,000 soldiers into areas with a lot of Luddite activity. The Luddites have to battle the British army. The government also tries to suppress things and infiltrate the group with spies. There's this terrible crackdown. We mentioned the death penalty for breaking specific types of weaving machines. And by winter of 1812, the government is winning. The organization has been infiltrated. In just 15 months, 24 different members of the Luddite movement are hanged as public examples. including a 16-year-old boy who cried out for his mom just before he was hanged, in case you're wondering who I think the bad guys are in this story.
Yeah, making an example, you know, of them after putting them in the position where they needed to organize in this way. What else did they have at this point? You know, they were not allowed to unionize. They were completely robbed of the only, you know, skill set they have, which that is an investment of time and history, you know, and just generational knowledge. And to all of a sudden just have that like totally yanked out from under you, and then to not have any, what are you supposed to do? Just starve? Die? I don't, I mean, it's just, it's cruel. History, and the history of industrialization and commerce, it can be so cruel.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard work. Not for nothing is it called the labor movement. These hangings are the result of some real kangaroo court type show trials. Actually, not to be too on the nose, 24 folks were sent up the river in the UK to prison, and then 51 were given the sentence of transportation, meaning after their kangaroo court, they were physically shipped to Australia. This is effective. This is some real scorched earth stuff the British government is doing. By 1813, the looks like the heyday of the Luddites is on the way out. A few years later, the group essentially vanished. And this doesn't mean it's the end of conflict between workers and owner classes. Very much not the case. You can hear about the Luddites today. You hear echoes of the fight against being replaced by machines in labor movements today, and threats of union strikes. Like right now, the nation, the United States, is rightly concerned about a possible industry-wide rail strike. And right now, if you don't think trains are that important, folks, and you haven't checked out Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, another show we do, realize that in the modern day, 30% of everything you buy is transported on rail at some point. And that is gonna, that when the stuff hits that fan, the stuff is gonna spread. You know what I mean? You've heard about this, right?
I have. And it also, you know, I think the bigger issue here too is that when you have these large scaled kind of operations that don't require specialized skills, you're not going to command as high a wage because they're going to hire a lot of people for a low wage, and they're technically replaceable, you know. And again, this is no ding on any individual like Amazon warehouse worker, or, you know, there certainly are varying degrees of skills required for different kind of industrial type jobs. Like, you know, you couldn't just walk into a car plant, like an automotive plant, and just know what you were doing. But there are certain jobs that are seen as being replaceable, like, for example, Starbucks workers trying to unionize. And in the eyes of the management, they might say, well, you know, these are entry level jobs. These are jobs that are for, you know, young people that anyone could come off the street and make a latte or whatever. I'm not saying that's the case, but that's the perception. And so the idea of unionizing when you are seen as replaceable is even more challenging. And the bigwigs and the corporations are more interested in busting that now than they ever have been, you know, or at least as interested. We've seen all kinds of, you know, union busting tactics employed by, you know, Starbucks and Amazon and things like that. It's technically illegal to do that. But if you're wealthy and powerful enough, there are always ways around it.
Yeah, well said. And it's a struggle that continues today. The idea of being caught beneath the thumb of powerful interests, being swept away by the tide of technological innovation, it's a common theme, and it's not going to go away in the future. Like we always point out, history is much closer than it might appear in your rearview mirror. And with that, I think we're going to call it a day. We've got some exciting stuff ahead. I don't want to spoil too much, but we do want to say a very, very special thanks to our guest super producer, Tari Harrison. Tari, I am sure you are frantically writing an email to Bill and Mark about their egregious lack of
transgression.
What is it? Will shall not stand.
This aggression will not stand. No.
Yeah. It's okay. Get
watch out
of the show. Yeah, and also thanks, of course, to Max Williams, who is on a well-deserved vacation. I've just been texting memes at times. We're waiting for some out of context pictures from his journeys. He'll be returning soon. Let's see who else.
Oh, Christopher Hasiotis, obviously, here in spirit.
Oh, yeah.
Soon to
yeah.
be here in the flesh. That's happening. I think we finally twist his arm to get that USB mic ordered.
Yeah, that's true. We did kind of muscle in on the poor guy. Buttonholed him. But
this is how we get things done. We make idle threats. You will have me on your podcast. Or I will smash your loom.
Yeah, and you know, we've still got our vision board thing going on. That's been making some progress.
Obviously.
Thanks, of course, to Jonathan Strickland, aka the Quister. Thanks to Yves Jeffcoat. Thanks to Anna Hosnier. Thanks to, well, now I feel like we're just award speeching. We got everybody. Like,
thank God.
I'll go Kanye. I'd like to thank me.
Yeah, you did this, man. You did this.
Oh, you did it. You did it.
We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit TomboyX.com to shop.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Woo!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high-five moment today? Only at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
I'm going out with the girls this weekend. Nails done, outfit stunner, and my skin? I know it's going to be glowing because I glammed up my shower routine with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. It smells so luxurious and deeply moisturizes with its super rich, creamy lather that's bursting with vitamin B3 complex. So my skin glows and my confidence grows. Try new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash for glowing skin in just 14 days.